Hello and welcome to as yet unnamed London Theatre Podcast for the 13th of September 2015. My name's TRP Watson, and this week I'm joined by Web Cowgirl, Phil from the West End Whingers, Tim from the Civilian Theatre, Johnny Fox and Paul in London. We're now going to talk about Kinky Boots the musical. This is a musical based on, well, not on the 1960s hit song by Patrick McNee and Honor Blackman. It's actually based on a 2005 movie written by Jeff Dean and Tim Firth. But the musical was taken on, oddly, in her first time of doing it. Music and lyrics are by Cyndi Lauper, and the book is by Harvey Fierstein. This production stars Cillian Donnelly as Charlie Price and Matt Henry as Lola. I don't know enough about it, so Web Cowgirl, can you tell me more about this and what it was like?
Well, a little background on the original, because I think a lot of the play's momentum is built from it having been based on a fairly popular movie. It's the genre of the feel good, everyday people's lives in England, group of people rising together to overcome some obstacles in their way, everybody happy and triumphant and cheering at the end. And it's set in, it's like, I don't really think of it as being a northern town, but it's another of the genre that's not about London, and it's about a factory town up north where the product that they've been making for the last 100 or so years, men's brogues, well, it turns out actually nobody wants to buy them anymore. So the question is there something we can do to save the factory? And the options are, well, do you want to save it as a historic monument? Or do you want to save it as a center of jobs for the area? And I think, you know, that's certainly an interesting storyline, though it does seem like it's a more appropriate for a movie than a musical. However, the original movie actually had a stage actor who has really gone on to do more and greater things. I can't really say his name very well. Chiwetel Ejiofor, who I first saw on stage, I don't know, 6 or 7 years ago. And you might be disappointed that he's chosen not to reprise his role, but I think he's moved on to bigger and brighter things as a stage star. But as a musical, this is, I think, just absolutely a successful production of a good time night out. It's not meant to be super deep, I don't think. It is meant to, I think, get you out of your seats and clapping and singing along and really getting behind what happens. The many areas that are explored have been simplified, but we do stick in part with one of the core stories, which is, can somebody who's grown up in a fairly conservative environment actually evolve themselves to a place where they can be friends with, you know, a man who likes to perform in short spangly dresses and high-heeled boots? It's the friendship between these two men that I think is the emotional heart of this play. So while it might on the surface be about, can you save a factory in a factory town, what it really becomes about is, can people learn to be more tolerant and accepting of one another? And that, I think, is the theme of this play. That is what really makes you want to put your hands up in the air and say, yeah, because it makes me feel like people aren't such mean and awful and hateful people as it seems like they are sometimes. And the characters are, you know, frequently broadly done, although I love the fact that they've got a factory that's, you know, 2/3 women, and it's not a bunch of back-of-show choreens with, you know, identikit features and legs and stuff performing in the factory. It's a range of women of different ages and different body types. It actually looks like normal people. And I feel the triumph of the factory is something that all of us can get behind in the audience. And lots of excellent singing and dancing and drag queens doing backflips on stage. I'm just going to rave on about it forever. I'm planning on going back. Phil, I'll turn it over to you.
I think I had two slight problems with Kinky Boots, although I'd actually really enjoyed the film, and that was unusual for me because I find usually these hit British comedies just leave me cold, and I only saw it sort of earlier this year for the first time and thoroughly enjoyed it, and it is a good story. I also had the expectation, because obviously it's famously the musical that beat Matilda to the big Tony Awards, for instance. The guy that played Lola, I think Billy Porter on Broadway, beat Bertie Carvel to his Miss Trunchbull in Matilda, and it won Best Musical over Matilda. So there was huge expectation. Plus, you know, it's got Harvey Fierstein, it's got Cyndi Lauper, who I like, both of them, and, you know, a good feel-good splashy night out. And the problem I had for the first half of Act One is I don't know if it was me, but I wasn't really engaging with it. And not helping with that engagement was the fact that everybody around me, including you, webcam girl, who was sitting next to me, I was very aware everybody else was having an absolutely fantastic time. And that's why I wanted to have. And then it kind of began to work for me about midway through Act One. There are three numbers in it, and they are the three best numbers in it, which come fairly close to each other sort of after halfway through Act One. There's the Sexes in the Heel number, which is all the drag queens and the factory workers, and it's a terrific number. And then it's quickly followed by Lauren, who's the sort of the possible love interest for Charlie Price, who's taken over the factory from his father, called The History of Wrong Guys. And it's got a really, for me, brilliant sight gag in it, which made me laugh out loud for the first time. And then it sort of began to sort of reach me. And then the first act closes with a number, Everybody Say Yeah, which is performed again by the factory workers and Charlie and Lola and her angels, Lola's angels, on factory conveyor belts, which are sort of spun around and moved around. And it's absolutely stupendous number. I mean, I would see the show again just for that, even though quite a lot of it left me feeling a little bit cold. So it's kind of probably one of the best numbers on in the West End at the moment, that particular number. I think generally the number is actually really good. They're very varied. I thought Killian Donnelly, who was Olivier nominated for The Commitments and absolutely stole The Commitments from me, steals the show again, which is kind of quite a hard thing to do, given that you're, you know, competing with a pretty competent drag queen. His voice is fantastic. It's a very different role from The Commitments. I think he's quite sensational in this. Again, the footwear bill must be enormous. The boots are great throughout. I was a little bit disappointed with the set. I felt it was a little bit static. It kind of sticks to the factory setting for most of it, and then just has this sort of thing that they spin around to make the other locations, which I thought sort of didn't have it the most sort of sensational look for the show. But then probably they'd spent so much money on the heels. I had a few problems in the second act. I thought I was more warmed up by then, but there's a really unnecessary moment where Lola sings a big number in a care home. And I felt that that's not in the film. It just felt like American kind of mawkishness thrown in there.
Hey, now, I'm not mawkish.
Well, you know what I mean. It's the kind of the big Broadway kind of moment to kind of move everybody. And it just left me absolutely frozen in horror. Yeah, kind of a bit of a mixed bag for me, not because it's not well done, which it is, just because I don't know, something about it didn't engage me. I didn't feel the script, actually, was quite as sharp as I would have expected from Harvey Fierstein. It wasn't making me laugh as much as I was, and it kind of felt I was being hit over the head by the message a bit.
I could really talk about it quite a bit. I love the boxing scene, which I thought was staged extremely inventively and nicely, as it turns out, plays off of that ad that just came out for instant noodles. And I agree that the sad number in the care home absolutely doesn't belong in the play.
Interestingly, I think the boxing number, I was thinking, I don't remember this from the film, but what's rather clever is that in the film it's an arm wrestling scene, which obviously wouldn't have impact on a large West End stage to do arm wrestling. And I thought, yeah, okay, that's a neat thing. I could sort of go with that. It's probably a bit unlikely, but it's an acceptable thing to do because arm wrestling is more likely that you would just do a kind of a spontaneous arm wrestle in a pub. I'll give you that one.
We're now going to talk about Hatched and Dispatched at the Park Theatre. This is a play by Gemma Page and Michael Kirk, I believe based on Michael Kirk's early life in Nottingham. It's directed by Michael Kirk and stars Wendy Peters, James Wright and Vicky Binns, Wendy Morgan, Kevin McGowan, Daniel Flett, Matthew Fraser Holland and Diana Vickers. It concerns people who have double booked a funeral and a christening on the same day, but it's really, really more about the funeral than the christening, about a couple of sisters, one of whom's just lost her husband, and the other of whom is something of, well, she's played by Wendy Peters in full, shall we say, Ma Hornet mode? I don't know if anybody would understand that, but I was slightly reminded of that, but probably for the wrong reasons. Ma Hornet from Sailor Beware, of course, which is the play that made Peggy Mount famous. And I've always wanted to see Wendy Peters in that, so perhaps that's what I had in mind. Although I have to say, if I was honest, I think the play rather wants to be the anniversary that had Bette Davis in it in the film and was done in the West End with Sheila Hancock, who was also in the original film. Tim, tell me more about this and what you thought of it.
I think the fact you've already mentioned two plays goes to the heart of some of what's good about this play, but also a lot of what I found quite problematic about it. Because if I didn't think of specific plays when I was watching it, my mind drifted to a whole range of playwrights from Joe Orton to Mike Lee, occasionally sort of allusions to almost Alan Bennett, but also primarily the kind of kitchen sink dramas of the 1950s. And at times I found the play was really quite powerful. It was often very funny, but throughout it seemed to have a curious tonal inconsistency where it didn't quite seem to settle on exactly what it needed to be. I mean, it opens almost as a sort of full-on classic British sex farce as two characters come careering into the room ahead of the funeral party and proceed to have rather quick sex on the middle of the drawing room floor. And the play kind of spirals from that point in the opening half as a fairly broad farce with some jokes which I think are quite funny but at times quite laboured. And I think one of the things about this play is there is at times the sense that this is a play written by quite fresh playwrights and there isn't perhaps a confidence to cut when it needs to be cut and just let a joke end rather than trying to wring every last drop of humour out of it. In the second half, it changes tack quite considerably and it opens with, I had to say, not particularly very well handled domestic violence scene. And as the characters have got progressively drunker, the family secrets inevitably begin to spill out. And towards the very end of the play, there's almost a very allegic feel to it, which has almost the sense that they're trying to reach what's a play by Chekhov. And you think to yourself, the journey which you've come on over the last 90 minutes or so has been one from 1950s sex farce to Chekhov. And it does create a certain sense of dissonance. So you're not entirely sure what it is the playwright wants you to take from it. Having said that, it was very funny in parts. It really was very funny in parts. And I think the casts are very much selling the play. Wendy Peters in that matriarchal role absolutely dominates proceedings. She's given the license of the script to do so and presumably the freedom of the director as well. And she is very, very watchable. But the whole cast is very good. I found Vicky Binns as Madeline Kershaw, the put upon daughter to be really very appealing and a very sort of pleasant stage presence, along with her husband, Matthew Fraser Holland, playing Oliver Kershaw. And out of a whole play, those two of them are fairly clearly set up as the heart of the piece. And it comes as no real surprise that they perhaps have less of a comeuppance than other characters. But overall, even with the very kind of committed performances and the occasional strong laughs, I did find it a problematic production in the sense of it never seemed to be quite sure of what it wanted to be.
John, what did you think?
I certainly agree it doesn't know what it wants to be. I think it says on the front of the programme, it doesn't say a new play by Michael Kirk and Gemma Page. It says a mucky romp through the morals, memories and music of the 1950s. So it's positioned as a bawdy comedy and it skirts with farce. One thing I just want to pick up on is that this is in any way a piece by a new or fresh playwright. Michael Kirk is in his 60s. And I think part of what's wrong with how this script developed is that from the germ of a very, very good idea, which stems from his 9-year-old observations of sexual and other shenanigans which happened in real life around the back of the Railway Institute in Derby when his parents were having a drink and he was kind of parked on the doorstep in the 50s or early 60s, is that his career has mostly been in sitcom and pantomime work. And I think it means that this script, especially in the larkier first half that Tim referred to, can sound very derived. I mean, there's a moment when Wendy Peters, who I absolutely adore, I mean, she can do no wrong. She's a wonderful actress and singer, and this is a great part for her. But as this great, as you quite rightly say, TRPW, Tim, the character is very forcibly modelled on Emma Hornet, the character that Peggy Mount plays in the film of Sailor Beware. There's a moment when Wendy Peters, as this matriarch, sends her daughters into the kitchen to cut sandwiches for the funeral with a line like, "You slice, I'll butter." And it is lifted directly from an early Victoria Wood stand-up routine, you know, a sketch that is famously quoted whenever anybody makes a sandwich in a lot of households. So I thought that was a bit awkward, really. It felt awkward watching it, because if you're going to be that funny, just be original. It wouldn't be hard to write a different line for that sort of situation. And there was a lot of it that was very echoing. There's a kind of nice marking of the shape of the script and the shape of the development of the characters as transitional from one era to another by the music that's positioned in the piece. You know, we start with a bit of Russ Conway and the strains of Mantovani, and then the younger characters are raving about the new crazies, which are Cliff Richard and Elvis. And that helps the first hour sort of skip along as the family kind of bickers and banters its way through this confusion of a funeral and a christening on the same day. I like the fact it was set in the Midlands. A lot of the reviews critiqued it as though it were a, in inverted commas, northern comedy, because they heard perhaps resonances of, you know, Alan Plater, Alan Sillitoe, Alan Bennett, you know, just to quote the Alans, and thought it might be from the kind of Manchester School of Kitchen Sink drama and comedy. But it's not. It's very precise. And Tim Lott in The Guardian wrote a very good piece in February bemoaning the fact that kitchen sink realism was an almost exclusively northern convention, and that the working class south of Manchester might as well not exist in literary terms. So here you have a very good piece of Midlands writing that I think, if you treat it as a first draft, could definitely evolve into a really excellent play. But some of the comic moments are so obvious, it's like waiting for the second shoe to drop. That the first act ends, and I don't think I'm giving anything away, that there's a setup for the substitution of a glass of sherry with somebody's urine pregnancy sample. And it's so painfully drawn out. And then the other thing is that family tensions and secrets are hinted at, and you know something more revelatory will come in the second half. But honestly, you know, if you can't guess that there's an unwanted pregnancy, an illicit love affair, and a little bit of domestic violence, well, you can't have been paying attention to EastEnders these last 30 years, because those situations are so readily available to put into drama if you're not trying too hard. But the second half, I thought, could come from a different and darker and better play. We start with the characters being mostly drunk, which is always an interesting challenge, both for the actors and for the script. And they're uninhibited enough to let out some really fiery recriminations. So all these situations that I've just spoken about are revealed, but they're revealed angrily, and there's a fight, and there's some hysterically funny, strong language, which seemed to me both more authentic and more amusing, and also more edgy, suggesting that, what we think of as quite a bland period in social history actually had, you know, a lot of things coming out from under the rug and a lot of tensions being released. And in this second act, I think Peters, who has beautifully set herself up in the first half as this outrageous, controlling mother, really finds her mark with deadly aim, and it becomes the kind of manipulative mother whose maternal milk has really truly turned sour. And she has some revenge lines and some script where she really hurts the other people in her family that I found affecting and accurate and painful. And the other, okay, you have to hand out is to Wendy Morgan. I don't know how much you know of Wendy Morgan, but I can't recall having seen her in very much, either on television or in the theatre, since she was Geraldine James's younger sister in Jewel in the Crown. Thought she was excellent then, and she is beyond excellent in this piece. She is self-pitying, brooding, and still. I mean, she's like a Derbyshire Blanche Dubois. It's that kind of inner reflective role that occasionally erupts into little flashes of really pungent and precise anger. And I think it's a superb performance. The rest of the cast are very fine as well. You could pick any of them out. Their roles tend to be a little bit more cameo-like. You've got James Wrighton playing the mother's boy who retaliates for his lifelong dominance by his own mother by hitting back at his wife and perhaps other women. I really liked Matthew Fraser Holland as the sheepish and slightly simpler cousin. And it's lovely to see Diana Vickers on stage. And she was so good in Little Voice. And this is a really charming and funny cameo. She plays Wendy Morgan's dippy and somewhat unselfconscious daughter. So I'd like to see it treated as a first draft, and I'd like to see it revised with the first half of the play darkened a bit more and detailed to match the second. And the other thing you can say is, well, even if you don't do that, this will be enormously popular with repertory companies and amateur dramatic societies, and Kirk and Page can look forward to a lot of royalties in the years to come because it will have a long life. And not everything has to be Pinter, but with this terrific ensemble, it certainly isn't short of entertainment value either.
I mean, I enjoyed this, but I kept thinking of other plays, and that was always the feeling. I felt that, especially towards the end, that when it gets much more dramatic, it lacked that dramatic punch in the end. It just hadn't built up for it. You didn't, there's things like, you didn't think the father was trapped, although he was supposed to be trapped, but you never thought he was truly trapped. One or two other things, I thought that the daughter of the nasty mother, they weren't really affected by it. I mean, she was just ignored and bullied a bit by the mother, but you could almost see that they could just walk away, and you felt that a lot of people could just walk away from this situation, and they hadn't really bulked it up, and it needed to be, I thought, it needed to be a lot stronger than that, a lot tougher. I liked it for what it was, but I think I wanted more, and I wanted it harder and somehow darker. And I have to say, it did remind me a lot of thinking, I wasn't sure if I wanted it to be The Anniversary, which is a play I quoted earlier, or whether it was that the play wanted to be The Anniversary. Having that really vicious mother figure that you have in The Anniversary, I mean, it's Betty Davis in an eye patch. It's almost unforgettable once you've seen that movie. That kind of really hard and vicious side to the mother, and she is nasty, but I think she's only a bully. She didn't really have the weapons other than the weapons of a bully, which is just to push you around and hope that you don't fight back, because she had nothing if they did fight back, because if the father leaves at the end of the play, then she's mucked up, and I didn't think for a moment that he couldn't. That's a slight problem, you know. know, they could have stood up against her and she would have lost. It's not like she was holding everything and holding everybody back, because she wasn't. And it just wasn't enough of that. It is to do with the plotting and perhaps to do with, you know, having a light-hearted early side that you don't really, you're not really getting into her being really manipulative and really strong and seeing how she's coping with all the different forces in her life. And I didn't think it was strong enough in the end. But it was, you know, it was entertaining for what it was, though. We're now going to talk about Dusty, which is a musical about Dusty Springfield and, what is it, celebrating the music of Dusty Springfield, it says here. A unique new multimedia fusion musical, it says in the blurb. I feel a little bit as if we're going to be kicking a dog when it's down. It has been in preview since May. It opened a week or so ago, so it's been hanging around a long time. So, Paul, should we be kicking it?
Well, yes and no. Actually, I really liked it because I like the music of Dusty Springfield. And I think when I first saw the movie Pulp Fiction, I really came to appreciate her music because Son of a Preacher Man was used to quite dramatic effect in that film. But this, as you said at the intro, it is a multimedia sort of fusion musical, and I think it's probably something that we're going to see a lot more of in the West End. Tribute shows with dead stars resurrected via large screens and, you know, spectacular effects. Sinatra, which is playing at the Palladium, is another of that, but probably they were a little bit more successful because they didn't probably try to create this dramatic story around it, and there wasn't the mixture of performers and then whisking off and then a video screen coming out. It seems like, although I haven't seen it, it seems like there's a lot more about the dancing and the band rather than trying to cobble together a great story. So this sort of version of theatre come attraction might be here to stay. And, you know, I think it tries, but it doesn't succeed entirely well. But I think part of that is they probably seem to be focusing more on the effects than the rest of the piece. The reviews were quite savage about the performances and the sound of the band, although I think maybe I was a little bit more appreciative of it because growing up watching mildly acceptable bands at various venues while we were on holidays with various international stars who I think became international because they probably toured New Zealand. I think I enjoyed the performances and music probably because it was recalling back to my childhood. But anyway, I think the whole thing is, the concept is great, but I think the execution wasn't so good, because when you're going to put a performer up against the studio recording of Springfield, you know, it's not going to show them off in their best light. And I think that's the whole problem with this piece, is that you've got a combination of performers and then they go off stage and then you have the studio recordings, and it doesn't actually make for a sort of seamless experience. Having said that, there are quite a few good performances in this piece. Whitney White is a revelation as Martha Reeves, and she gives the show quite a lot of injection of energy and enthusiasm, and she has quite a few good moves, who becomes a bit of a friend to Dusty, both in the piece but also in real life. And Francesca Jackson as Dusty's friend Nancy also comes off a bit better because she gets some full songs to sing rather than snatches of vocals going on or off stage as Alison Arnott as Dusty gets to play. Having said that, though, I think the music is great, and that's what I enjoyed about the piece. And it's probably one of the more elaborate productions to make it to Charing Cross Theatre in recent times. And so I think if they ditched the narrative and just focus on the music, this would have been a much better show. But I'll let John provide his alternate view.
Yes, John, is it going to be the Dusty Bin?
I don't have a completely alternate view, because as far as it went, I agree with Paul. The music is terrific. I grew up with the music of Dusty Springfield, and I was delighted that she should become the subject of a jukebox musical. But the jukebox musical has become such an easy and familiar formula that even the people who make it underestimate what it has to be. To succeed, you've got to do one of two things. Either you've got to deliver blood-pumpingly authentic versions of a hugely popular back catalogue so that people are dancing in the aisles, or you have to tell a brutally truthful, possibly undiscovered warts and all story about the star in question. When you get the two together and you do it right, you've got beautiful. When you put the two together and you do neither, you've got dusty. And that's unfortunate because, as Paul says, this is possibly the most expensive staging of anything yet at Charing Cross Theatre. And you go in there and you think, oh my God, it's not the usual cardboard nonsense on stage. This looks quite West End-y, which is great. But the narrative is appalling. It's all culled from Wikipedia. It's a weak summary of events only in the first half of Dusty's life and denuded of all of the passion and all of the drama, just delivered as a simple interview between the best friend, Nancy, who may or may not be a real person. I think not, actually, or at least a composite, and a reporter. And I didn't like Francesca Jackson, as much as Paul did. I thought she performed as though she was quite sullen at not being cast as Dusty herself. Although she might have been, because her vocals were a bit closer to Dusty Springfield's than Alison Arnup, who plays her. But the thing about Dusty Springfield, you know, the blue-eyed, blonde-haired voice of American soul in Britain, if you like, was that her voice was unique and is unmatchable. So getting anywhere near a caricature is going to be wrong. And I do wish that they'd had the bravado to allow more of the songs to be sung by the performers rather than intermixed and intercut with television footage of Dusty herself. I mean, they did very well to get so much of it, but it's overused. And sometimes, you know, poor Alison Arnup is being shuffled off stage to make room for a black and white version of Dusty belting something on a Saturday night on BBC in one of her trademark jewel-encrusted long 90s. I agree about the band, though. They really are not good enough. It's a nice idea that the band should also be the performers in the show. And a young man called Leo Elso, who is, I think, their lead guitarist, even looks a bit like Tom Springfield. But there were some terrible popping brass notes, and the sound was really badly distorted with feedback. So the band weren't able to give off their best. But the music and the moves aside, it's what's left out of the book that is so shocking, given that even if you just enter into Google the three words Dusty Springfield lesbian, it throws up a couple of dozen far more interesting episodes and at least two serious partners who are not mentioned in this play. Dusty was quite druggy, if you like. She needed pills and vodka to embolden her advances to other women at a time that information about such things could have broken her career. The show hints that Martha Reeves may have been Dusty's friend, but they had an affair, plain and simple. You know, it was a physical relationship that is just too much skirted around here. And then when Dusty was somewhat in the grip of her addictions, she lost some great chances. Elton John originally planned to duet Don't Go Breaking My Heart with her, which, had he actually done it with Dusty and not with Kiki D, would have solved all her financial problems. She was offered Killing Me Softly before they offered it to Roberta Flack, and she was lined up to sing Nobody Does It Better as the Bond movie soundtrack, but she couldn't pull herself together enough even to go to the studio, and so they replaced her with Carly Simon. Those are really good episodes that could have been brought into a more extended biography, instead of which they toss around with her, you know, early life in Ealing and far too long when she's supporting her brothers in their kind of folk group. I mean, it just ignores the fact that she was a dramatic, violent and self-harming woman. She spent time in a mental ward at Bellevue Hospital in New York. She had a screaming match in the street, which was only calmed down by Billie Jean King. In her later life, she demanded that her rubbish be cut up into equal-sized pieces for the bins and watched Bonanza in German all day on television and ate only cauliflower and ice cream. Now, I know that makes her mad, but it also makes her interesting. And did she really have an affair on Mystique with Princess Margaret? I mean, it's all crazy. It's all wonderful. I mean, it could be wonderful theatre. If you could script it, you'd have a show that sort of rivaled End of the Rainbow. You know, Peter Quilter's Judy Garland musical, which shows Judy, you know, at the end of her life and very dependent on drink and drugs. So I feel it's unfortunate that they didn't pick better bones out of the very interesting Dusty Springfield story. And all I can say is that the only way it could be worse is that in 2005, Kristin Chenoweth announced that she was going to play Dusty in a biopic. Unfortunately, that never happened.
We're now going to talk about The Man Who Had All the Luck by Arthur Miller. This is running at the King's Head Theatre and looks rather interesting. John, can you tell me more about this and what you thought of it?
Yeah, I can tell you that it's not quite Arthur Miller's first play, but it's his first publicly performed one. He wrote it when he was about 25 in 1940, when it won the Theatre Guild Award, the national award for a new play by a new playwright. But it wasn't actually performed until 1944, when it ran only four nights on Broadway and got the most terrible reviews and closed. What's really interesting about it is it's the story set in small town America about a young garage mechanic and his dreams and ambitions and how almost everything he wants to do or touches turns to gold. But it has themes in it which foreshadow the best work that Arthur Miller produced. There is an uneasy relationship between two brothers and their father, and the patination, if you like, of their father's ambition on them is a very close reflection of what happens both in All My Sons and in Death of a Salesman. There is a character whose downfall comes because he has had an illicit affair with a prostitute, which again, you know, you find in Death of a Salesman. I mean, there are so many resonances. It's almost as if you can see Miller testing the themes that he wanted to develop in later work. And it's good because of that. It's good because of, if you know the canon, you will see lots of things. But it's also a very good play in its own right, particularly in this production. I think it's tremendously well done. And of course, it has the great advantage of not being a text that we all had to wade through for O level or A level or whatever it is. So David Beeves, the young hero of the piece, is dating a girl whose father is violently opposed to their relationship. And then just as he's about to go and see the man and tell him that they really want to get married, there's a terrible accident and the guy dies in a car accident. And that's just the beginning of a train of events where David becomes more and more successful, almost without effort. And you're not angry or jealous of him, or you don't think it's an injustice, because he is such a thoroughly nice and decent guy. And this, of course, again, is a Miller meme, that he's very supportive of guys who are nice and good and honest and likes to play down those that have any kind of baggage to carry. It's not entirely successful as a narrative. There are holes in it, but this production has been done, I think, really extremely well. You're tightly arranged around a narrow thrust stage, and some of the entrances are a little bit awkward, but it's really impressive, you know, just how many characters are presented by this troupe of very, very good ensemble actors. I wanted to say something about how the stage could feel crowded in other hands, but because these actors are so good and because they work so well together, it's a very lucid telling of quite a complicated story, and you really are carried along by it. And it's a very long piece in terms of, I think it's about an hour and a half before you even get to the interval, and then there's a shorter burst of the second act. And I was resistant to that when I read about that on the way into the theatre, but really it does drive you along, and I really was completely engrossed in it and very happy to follow it to the denouement. And there are some terrific performances. Jamie Chandler plays this young man, David, and he has great control, a very nice body language and speaking manner, and he seems very relaxed, even though he has a huge job to do to carry most of the dialogue and all of the plot. His girlfriend, then wife, Hester, played by Chloe Walsh, I thought was also very good. Lots of variations in her emotion, but also handled extremely well. And then there's a strange character played by Alex Warner, who in some versions of the production is just called The Man, and in others is actually named as I think he's a Dutch character called Gus Van something or other. And you're not quite sure whether he's a real character who has just moved into the town, or if he's like a dramatic device, like the external person who enters into the familiar situation, like the inspector, and the inspector calls, or if he might actually be something a little bit supernatural, like the lady from Dubuque in the Edward Albee play. He's got an eeriness about him, and he appears in the middle of the night as a person who solves David's mechanical problem on a car. It's like the elves and the shoemaker. You know, it's like something in an Aesop's fable where something slightly magical happens during the middle of the night, and in the morning everything is very much better. So I liked it for all these layers of subtlety and complexity that Miller had put into the play, which is really, really astonishing for something by a 25-year-old writer. You know, we see on the fringe an enormous amount of first plays by a lot of people, but you know, you could definitely spot in this that this was a, you know, someone who had the absolute gift of being a playwright. But Paul, tell me, you saw it on a different night from me. Tell me how you reacted to it.
I loved it. I think I was equally engrossed with the piece, and I think it was the first serious play I've seen at the King's Head for a while, because there's been a series of cheap and cheerful gay plays, I guess we could say, that have been going on there for some time.
Yes. Or plays for cheap and cheerful gays.
Yes, but like that. The cast that they've assembled for this piece, and it's a fairly new production company called End of Moving Walkway. They've assembled a terrific cast, and in addition to the names that John mentioned, would have to single out Peter Dineen, who gets to play a range of men who act as sort of key people in David's success, but also in one case, a key obstacle. And the acting is all around is terrific, but it's in the scene where Peter Dineen is playing the father of Hester, who becomes David's wife, there is this wonderful, wonderful monologue that the father delivers, which gives a sort of a damning assessment of David, who he is. And the brilliance of this monologue is that then you think about that in your mind as the rest of the play is unfolding, because you're thinking, well, he's not really much of a guy. And so, you know, it must be all luck, and it must be, you know, he must have some sort of mythical touch. So I think it's a wonderful cast. It's a wonderful piece. And I think it's probably, you know, it's very simply staged, but it is so effective. And I think, as you said, many of the pieces, themes rather, that Miller would explore in his later works about America, freedom, capitalism, they all sort of starting to form while watching this piece. I think the piece, as it gets into the third act, where it focuses more on is the character going mad, it does seem to lose its momentum. But I think by the time you get to the third act, you've been so engrossed and drawn in by these characters and these terrific performances that you almost don't mind it terribly much. But it's terrific production and well worth seeing before it finishes at the end of September.
We're now going to talk about And Then Come the Nightjars. This is a play by B. Roberts, directed by Paul Robinson, on at the Theatre 503. John, this can't be your first trip to the Theatre 503, or is it just you're nervous of the place?
I'm not nervous of it. It's just, for Fringe Theatre, it's possibly the worst journey I have to make. It's completely the wrong side of town, and it involves at least two trains, and for me, what I think is the oddest bus in all of South London, which has its opposite destinations, Peckham and South Kensington. But between there, it just threads its way through all these dark streets that, you know, form most of Battersea, Clapham and whatever else there is down there. But I might have set out with reluctance, but I am absolutely delighted that I did go to see And Then Come the Nightjars, because it was so much worth the slightly long haul journey. It's a compact and beautifully, sensitively observed two-hander from a woman writer called B. Roberts, who I think has been raised on the outskirts of Dartmoor. And it recently won, in 2014 at any rate, it won at the new inaugural Theatre 503 Playwriting Award, which gets it £6,000 and a production at 503, and also a production at the Bristol Old Vic, where I think it will also be extremely well received when it goes there in October. Like all good writing, it has something factual at its base, perhaps, and it focuses on the way the foot and mouth outbreak of 2001 is reflected by shaping and shifting the friendship of the two characters, a lifelong dairy farmer and herdsman called Michael, played by David Fielder, who's done a lot of good stuff at the RSC, and his good friend and also the local vet, Jeffrey, played by an actor called Nigel Hastings, who's done a lot of good work at Birmingham Rep. Really very, very good performers, both of them, surprisingly so, to have actors you might not be terribly familiar with doing such immensely good work. Both of them have lost the women in their lives. Michael has lost his wife Sheila to sudden and aggressive cancer. Jeffrey is losing and eventually has lost his wife, really by being a boozing tosser. But the plot works surprisingly well because there's a very early pivot in it, which Roberts gets out of the way really well, because obviously once you know it's about the foot and mouth outbreak, you know the inevitable conclusion is that the herd must be sacrificed and that Jeffrey the vet must be in charge of that. And so there's tension, and obviously someone gets a shotgun out and threatens the people from the Ministry of Agriculture and all that kind of thing, but it is accomplished. And then the way it has been done, it becomes transformative to the men's relationship. And they drift really nicely between kind of waiting for Godot-esque soul-searching and a kind of warm and wry comedy that sort of belongs in The Odd Couple, because they are such a mismatched pair of men to be good friends. So the West Country location and Third Fielder's impeccable accent are, you know, a million miles from Ambridge. I mean, this is the wonderful thing about it, that it is a piece of West Country drama that has no taint of the Archers about it. And the other thing that helps the thing along really, really well is Max Dory's near-perfect set. I think this is a tremendous piece of work. It is a cow barn. It feels like you are in a real cow barn, down to the shit on the floor and the bits of straw, and Sally Ferguson's lighting, which sends beams highlighting the dust and slanting through the broken laths in the roof of the barn. It's just such good, realistic work. Very, very high quality. But it's in the observation of these two rather difficult personalities that both B. Roberts' script and Paul Robinson's direction just made it for me. I mean, never for a moment you disbelieve either of the characterizations. You could say towards the end that the plot is tied up a little bit too neatly and certainly a touch too sentimentally. But the way in which these men resolve their differences is really quite beautifully done. I think it'll have a longer life. This is becoming for me a bit of a yardstick with new writing. You know, where can I see it going? Certainly these two actors would have the confidence and the ability to take it into the West End if a transfer were on the cards. And you know, it has that kind of texture of a really good Donmar Warehouse piece. But I think the other thing that may happen to it is that star names will be attracted to it. And I can see a lot of senior actors really wanting to get their hands on a piece of writing of this originality and quality. Paul, what did you think?
I'm with you. I think this was an incredible piece of theatre. All the more incredible because it is B. Roberts's first full-length production. And it was the winner of the first Theatre 503 Writers Award from last year. And I think, which just must show the quality of the writing that's around at the moment is something to be admired as well. But I think what's exciting about this play is that it's not just about the original foot and mouth crisis, which had a catastrophic effect on this man's farm and his livelihood, but it's what actually happened next and the relationship that changes from, you know, mild friendship to a much, much stronger bond by the end. And it was funny you should mention Waiting for Godot and The Odd Couple, because actually I was thinking that it had some of that inclusions, you know, Waiting for Godot, The Odd Couple, but also a bit of maybe Grey Garden if there were men, because everything starts to decay around them and they're just clinging onto this way of life. But it is so well done. It's so tenderly told. And it's so funny as well that I think you can't help but not like this piece. And, you know, it seems to be getting, you know, sold out audiences every night at the moment, just looking at the Twitter feeds, but also it's got some great reviews. So it surely is worthy of being transferred to the West End and having a much longer life than just this month at Theatre 503. But again, also, I think the cast of David Fielder and Nigel Hastings was also quite inspired. They have a great rapport between each other and both have quite a long list of credits to their names. And I realized David Fielder has been in lots of films and television over the years as well. So he certainly looked familiar. And Nigel Hastings as well, also having been in Four Weddings and a Funeral, amongst other things. So I think it's a terrific cast and it looks beautiful. It looks great. If you can get a ticket, I would just say go for it.
You can find us at AYULTP on Twitter, on the as yet unnamed London Theatre Podcast page at Facebook, on the web we are AYULTP.com. The podcast can also be found on both iTunes and Stitcher, where you can leave a review. Thank you. Goodbye.